Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. The delicatessen has changed. You'll know what I mean after a visit to Zingerman's Deli in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For something more traditional, where else would you go but New York? And then we'll consider some foods critical to any self-respecting prepared foods emporium. So let's dig in. In 1982, Paul Saginaw and Ari Weinzweig opened Zingerman's Deli in a red brick building in Ann Arbor, Michigan, so they could get a decent corned beef sandwich. After 26 years, they have built an empire called Zingerman's Community of Businesses that Inc. magazine called the coolest small company in America. They've even been on Oprah. This is not your grandfather's deli. Yes, Zingerman's has corned beef, pastrami, and chopped liver. But they also carry estate-bottled olive oils, farmhouse cheeses, varietal vinegars, grits from South Carolina, and chocolate bars from Madagascar. In Ann Arbor, Zingerman's is to food what the University of Michigan is to education. After a successful first decade, it was time to grow. Another Ann Arbor institution, Borders Books, grew out of Ann Arbor. Zingerman's had a different idea. Co-founder Ari Weinzweig.
There was sort of the challenge that if you don't replicate, how do you grow? So we came up with a vision that outlined this community of businesses where we would have a series of different Zingerman's businesses, but all here in the Ann Arbor area, each with its own unique specialty, operating as one organization, but with these sort of semi-autonomous pieces within it, and each with managing partner or partners in it that had a financial stake invested and had a passion for running it.
The first new Zingerman's was a bakery. It runs 24 hours a day, turning out traditionally made breads. Esquire magazine singled out Zingerman's farm loaf in its best sandwich feature.
Right now I'm actually very high on what we call the Roadhouse bread. It's actually historical roots are, it was the bread of New England in the 18th and 19th century. It was then called Ryan Indian bread. And it's in pretty much every New England cookbook from that era. It's a mix of rye, wheat, and cornmeal. And it's got a little molasses in it, which historically used to come up in abundance from the West Indies with the rum. And it's a fantastic bread, but I also love the farm bread. I love the French mountain bread we do, which is organic germ restored. And I like them in the really big loaves. We do it in a 2-kilo traditional loaf, which is great.
That's more than 4 pounds of bread. Now, in addition to the deli and bakery, there's Zingerman's Creamery, where local milk is used to make fresh cheese, old-fashioned cream cheese, and gelato. Try the pistachio. Zingerman's mail order brings in close to 30% of their business. Zingerman's Coffee Company is a wholesale roaster, and Zingerman's Roadhouse is a full-service restaurant serving regional American food. Did I mention Zingerman's Catering? Since by 2007 they'd already accomplished everything in their 2009 vision, they don't do strategic planning, they do visioning. They've begun work on Zingerman's 2020 vision. What's left to do? Ari Weinzweig.
Anything to do with food. You could pick a cuisine. We could have that restaurant.
They encourage employees to come up with good ideas and start a Zingerman's business. And all employees know the bottom line since Zingerman's posts its sales figures on big dry erase boards weekly. This year, they project $34 million in sales. Weinzweig expects there will be 12 to 18 interrelated Zingerman's businesses by 2020. As of today, there is interest in a traditional Mexican restaurant, food publishing, traditional brewing, organic farming, and a spice shop. But the 2020 vision is about more than new businesses, says Weinzweig, who wears black jeans, black T-shirt, and earrings and looks more like an old hippie than a CEO.
The sustainable farmer always leaves the soil in as good or better a condition as when he or she started the work. And so the lead of the 2020 vision is really our commitment to do that, not just for the soil, but for everything and everybody that we interact with, so that when people work here, that they leave employment here, whether it's short or long term, better for the experience, that as a customer you leave better for the experience, that the people that we buy from are better for having sold to us, that the community is better off for us having been here, and then, of course, all the environmental and food issues as well. And then, you know, it goes through a whole range of things from having fun to continuing to radically improve our food quality and our service quality and to be an educational resource, et cetera.
Whatever they do, Ari Weinzweig says they won't stop having fun.
Fun is in our guiding principles, and it's in the 2020 vision. Life is short, and even when times are hard, which they have been and I'm sure will be again, you know, it's important to enjoy the people and the food and the customers and everything that we get to be around. I mean, I feel very fortunate to be around such a great group of people and to work with such great products.
Let's go get a sandwich at the deli. I'm sick and tired of peanut butter and jelly. Something really good to fill my belly. Well, let's go get a sandwich at the deli. Zing-a-man, zing-a-man, zing-a-man. Let's go get a sandwich at the deli. Zing-a-man, zing-a-man, zing-a-man. Let's go get a sandwich at the deli.
Years ago, New York City's Second Avenue Deli closed down with little advance notice. Customers showed up as usual and found the doors padlocked. Now the Second Avenue Deli is back, albeit on Third Avenue. NPR's Allison Stewart, Dan Pashman, and Wynn Rosenfeld have been to the old and the new.
So, Dan, what's the backstory?
Well, the Second Avenue Deli alley opened in 1954, the corner of Second Avenue and 10th Street, and it was an institution, like you said. I had a similar situation. I went there to bring a friend from out of town, got there, the doors padlocked shut. No one knew this was coming.
So sad.
And it was there from 1954 until 2006. It closed very abruptly, and people were really, really upset. And we put together a video piece we're going to be posting on the web. We went to the new Second Avenue Deli. But first, to help people understand how crushing it was when this place closed, here are some clips from our video piece of how people found out the news and how they dealt with it.
I read about it in the New York Times. I read the Times every single day. They cover everything.
I thought it was terrible.
Friends tell friends. We all know.
I thought it was dreadful. I mean, it was probably because of the rent.
Word of mouth reaches me before the internet. It's faster than any electrons.
We didn't know what we'd do. We ate a lot of Italian and Chinese food.
Oh, that's a good. She found a good solution. Yeah. So how did it come to reopen, Wynn?
Well, it came to reopen basically the nephew of the owner who was tragically murdered, Abe Leibowald. Decided to take on the family business and with his bringing it back into existence and with the same pride in the menu. It's on Third Avenue now, actually, not Second Avenue, but
keeping the name Second Avenue Deli,
keeping the food.
All right, what did you order, Wynn?
I had the pastrami, and I just want to just say one thing here is that I am, you know, normally Dan is the guy who should talk about food things because he is a
yes.
gourmand.
That's my beat.
An unbelievable palate, and if you guys know me, I have the same salad, the same yogurt every single day. And this was a situation where it haunted me. This pastrami sandwich stuck in my mind, in my heart, in my soul.
And your arteries.
In my arteries. For weeks. And 2 weeks later, I said, well, you know, I'm going to get a pastrami sandwich from Arty's, which is another deli near in my neighborhood.
Doesn't work.
Oh, it's so tragic.
Arty's is fine, but that just does not work. Dan,
Second Avenue Deli will ruin you for pastrami.
What did you think?
It was as good as always. It was as good as always, and it was amazing. And I still haven't quite gotten back to equilibrium. I'm going to need to have a few more pastrami sandwiches. But most importantly, what did the customers think? Here's another clip from our video piece. Let's hear what the customers had to say about the new Second Avenue Deli.
I love the gefilte fish. I love chopped liver. I love salami.
Chopped liver's delicious. Just can't get it anywhere else like this, so that's what makes it special.
A marvelous marriage of delicatessen meat flavors. Spicy, delicious, perfumed, very, very heady, and enough to put you into a trance.
What makes for a good Frankfurter?
If it's a kosher Frankfurter or the one from Coney Island. Otherwise, they suck.
Oh, my. Well, if you're not close enough to taste the pastrami and you want to see it, check out the video piece that Wynn and Dan did. It's at our website, npr.org/Bryant Park. Thanks, guys, for reporting.
Right.
I'm worried about you guys.
Took over the team there.
That was NPR's Allison Stewart, Dan Pashman, and Wynn Rosenfeld. You can't, of course, have a deli without mayonnaise. That would mean no tuna salad or coleslaw. There are differing theories about who made the first mayonnaise, but the most common one, and the one I like best, is explained by NPR's Debbie Elliott.
A French general by the challenging name of Louis-François Armand de Plessis, Duc de Richelieu, led his troops onto the island Minorca in June of 1756 and took it from the British. Minorca is a tiny island off the coast of Spain, but it was strategically key to the British Navy, so the French Duke's victory was a big deal.
Well, in order to celebrate this meal, the Duke's chef created a new sauce.
That's Richard Gutman, curator of the Culinary Archives and Museum of Johnson and Wales University in Providence, Rhode Island.
And evidently he was lacking some cream to mix with the egg yolks, and he used oil instead, and the new sauce became mayonnaise, which would be a derivation of Port Mahon, which was the port that they had conquered.
Now, just to be fair, we should say this story does have its detractors.
Absolutely. It's not ironclad, and when you're trying to pinpoint the origins of foods, there are many claims. And one is a theory that attributes the sauce's origin to the Basque region town of Bayonne, and it was originally called Bayonnaise sauce, which somehow became mayonnaise sauce. Not sure about that one. Another hypothesis is that it came from the old French word for egg yolk, moyeu, and mayonnaise became corrupted into mayonnaise. And a fourth version would be from the French verb manier, which was also an obsolete word for to stir. So take your pick. Certainly the Richelieu one is compact and nice, and the Mayon makes sense to me.
Richard Gutman of the Culinary Archives and Museum. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Debbie.
So, how did mayonnaise become a staple of the American diet? Well, a German immigrant named Richard Hellman opened a deli in New York City in 1905. His wife's recipe for mayonnaise was used in many of the deli's salads, and it became so popular that Mr. Hellman began selling it in little wooden boats used to weigh butter. He sold two varieties, actually, and to distinguish between them, he placed a blue ribbon around one. By 1912, he started bottling the blue ribbon version, and you probably don't even have to run to your fridge to know there's still a blue ribbon on the label of every jar of Hellman's, or Best, as it's called in the West.
That was NPR's Debbie Elliott. Finally, what reputable deli wouldn't serve bagels? But deli mavens know that before there were bagels, there were bialys. Named for the town of Bialystok in Poland, they're flatter and more sour-tasting than bagels. While they're not common in Poland anymore, even now, a bialy bakes in Brooklyn at Coney Island Bialys and Bagels. The founder's grandson, Steve Ross, talks with NPR's Karen Michelle.
The easiest way to describe a bialy would be a round English muffin with an indentation in the center.
That's for those fragrant onions or the garlic.
That's the easiest way to describe it. The taste is nowhere near an English muffin.
Or a bagel either. Bagels have malt or sugar and are boiled. Bialys are just flour, salt, yeast, and water, and baked. Ross says the New York water is essential. And really, he should know.
I was born in the business, literally. My grandfather started the business. He was born in a town of Poland with his two brothers. He came to the United States. The town that they were born in was called Bialystok, Poland. They learned the trade there. And when they came to the United States, they basically did what they knew best, make bialys.
That was around 1920, when Ross's grandfather opened his first store, selling a product that went by a different name back home. Food critic Mimi Sheridan wrote the book on the subject, The Bialy Eaters, The Story of a Bread and a Lost World.
They were called Kuchen, which is really a German word for cake, but was used for this little bun. And they were known as Bialystoker Kuchen. And in the areas around there, the Jews of Bialystok were known as Bialystoker Kuchenfressers, meaning prodigious eaters of Bialystoker Kuchen.
Now, in the shop, the eaters of Bialy's come from all over. Of course, Coney Island Avenue in Brooklyn is a lot like being all over.
I'm from Queens, originally from Haiti. I've been coming here for a long time, maybe 15 years. It's like coming home. The faces change, but the Bialy's remain the same.
My name is Eugene.
Eugene is one of the new faces at Coney Island Bialy's and Bagels. He's worked here about a year, mostly behind the counter. He's from a part of Russia that used to be a part of Hungary.
They have similar like Bialy's, but not Bialy's. They have like Bialy's that's without onion. Not onion inside, you know? That's why I like more Bialy's and Bagels. And we have a lot of people who comes here from my town and from my country and from Hungary, and they love it. They love it. It's like home, you know? Not today, like it was 25 years ago home, you know? Not today. All time is over.
Though it's not entirely over here. This bakery is no Entenmann's or Blimpie's. Steve's still got the original neon sign outside, and inside there's a table that just gets fixed and fixed rather than replaced. The very few machines are irreplaceable, they're so old, and it feels as if the flower of the ages resides in the back storeroom. Even the enormous brick-lined ovens are the originals, their jaws opening to reveal revolving racks for baking the bagels and Bialy's. Though Steve Ross still keeps his ovens burning constantly. When his grandfather and then his father ran the business, people ate more Bialy's and way more bagels.
Now we're making about 150 to 200 dozen a day.
And it used to be?
Close to maybe 1,000 dozen a day.
Partly, it's the competition from all of those other bagel places. Mimi Sheraton thinks it's probably the product.
Well, I think the onions are definitely one factor. There are many, many people who cannot contemplate roasted onions first thing in the morning. It takes a strong palate, I think, for that.
So Steve Ross is branching out, experimenting with other flavors. To purists' horror, now he's got a cinnamon raisin Bialy. Still, he doesn't know if there'll be a fourth generation of Bialy makers in the family.
I think there will be Bialys. I think what it'll be is I don't think there'll be bakers.
Mimi Sheraton is more concerned for the future of the baked good.
In my lifetime in New York, there will probably always be some Bialy's. Eventually, perhaps not. Or there will be something called Bialy's that would be unrecognizable.
Of course, travel the United States and you'll find all sorts of things called a Bialy, including one in Texas made with jalapenos. And if you really want to travel, Bialystok, Poland has Bialys again. You'll find them in a shop called the Broadway Deli. For NPR News, I'm Karen Michel in New York.
Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and lots of recipes. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.